Seymour, and I'd like to now introduce the second of tonight's speakers, which is Elise.
Thanks, Gary. I'm surrounded by all sorts of electronic gizmos. Hi, everybody. My name's Louise. I'm an addict.
Hi, Louise.
It's nice to be here. It's quite nerve-wracking. There's a lot of eyes on you in here. It's quite a big room. And I was thinking when I was walking down here from work, God, I really meant to think about what I was going to say before I came here tonight. Zina phoned me up a couple of weeks ago, must be at least a couple of weeks ago, and asked me to do this. And I thought, oh yeah, great, I'll go to speaker meeting. I've done quite a few chairs here. In the first couple of years this meeting started, it must be, what, 4 or 5 years old, this meeting now. I did a couple of 40-minute chairs, and then there was a clean time requirement, and I got banned from doing it. Banned, you know, in place. It's true. and then I did a series of 15-minute chairs. I've done a few of the 15-minute ones, and those chairs you have to be quite kind of brief and focused. And the sort of speaking that I've done, the chairs that I've done recently have been mainly step chairs, and they're relatively simple to do because you read the step, you think about what kind of illuminating experiences you have related to that step, you go up, turn up, deliver your chair, and that's it. Bob's your uncle. Quite easy, really. But a 40-minute chair here, it gives you an opportunity to have a kind of proper run at your story. And I've got a good story, so strapping. But I did mean to plan to sort of think, well, I'll spend a few minutes on this and then I'll do that and I'll do it. But I was really busy today and I forgot. So in the way, I'm completely unprepared. So I hope that I'm able to deliver something that makes relative sense. I'm spending quite a bit of time with somebody at the minute who's just started going to AA. And it's quite an interesting case, because he's not had a drink for about 2.5 years, but has over the last sort of 6 months gone progressively madder. And I have been suggesting to him for ages that, well, why don't you go to AA? Why don't you try AA? And he's been going, and he's been coming back and sort of reporting back. And he said to me that he keeps going to meetings and hearing people talking about how doing the 12 steps and the fellowship, attending that fellowship has changed their life. But they never say how. And he says, is this like some sort of secret? Is there another secret meeting? They all talk about how it's actually done because he's none the wiser. And the rest you can say, well, you know, you just have to keep turning off and it'll be revealed and all that rubbish that we come out with. So I'm hoping that I will be able to talk about how I have transformed what was a hopeless life into one that is full of hope. And you might leave thinking, well, I understand how she did that. So I won't waste too much time on childhood and stuff like that, as it's just quite boring, all that stuff, really, isn't it? I was a miserable child, although if you ask my mother, she would deny this. In one of our moments of honesty a few years ago, I said to her, you know, I was a really unhappy child, and she said, no, you weren't. Gives you sort of indication of what my family life was like. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother was just very angry all of the time. I had a brother who was much older than me, about 5-6 years older than me, who was just brutal to me. And so I was a miserable child, and I was frightened all the time. But of course, then I didn't know that's what that was. I didn't know what fear was. I didn't actually know what fear was until about 3 or 4 years ago, actually. And I just thought that was what being me felt like, and I didn't really understand that that you could feel differently to that. And the feeling different to that I found in drugs. And I was attracted to the whole drugs kind of scene. It was, you know, it's in the kind of late 70s, and it was in Glasgow then, it was quite an unusual thing to do, especially from the sort of part of Glasgow that I came from. It was, you know, everybody wasn't doing it. And it felt quite dark and subversive. And reckless, and I was attracted to all that. You know, my childhood heroes were people like Jim Morrison. you know, Jimi Hendrix, those sorts of people that all ended up dead, but I didn't factor that into my thinking. I took drugs. The heroin was one of the first drugs that I took, and I loved it. It removed that fear, even though I didn't know that was what it was doing at the time. But I was extremely comfortable with the way it felt. I didn't consider not using it again the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that. It didn't enter my head that this is something you would try once and not try again. And I ended up, I was one of the early recipients of methadone on prescription in about 1979, I think that was, 79. And my parents found out about that because you had to go to a social worker as well. The social worker phoned the house. And so this ended up with me being frog marched off to treatment when I was 18. And at the same time, my dad was frog marched off to dry out because he was one of those drunks that would drink for long periods, you know, months, years, and then he would stop for sort of 3 or 4 months. And then we'd all be sitting waiting for it to, you know, when that dam was going to break, which inevitably it always did. So the one of these periods was going to go and dry out. And we both went off, and he was driving, and we drove down to, I was delivered to Oxford, and he went to dry out in Cambridge somewhere, a very academic recovery. So I went to this place, which in a treatment centre then, they were very different. This is 30 years ago. Unbelievably, I'm 48. So treatment centres were very different then. There only was 3 or 4 in the country. And they were all in competition with each other as well, which was weird. Although I had no real interest in stopping taking drugs, to be honest with you, it was a long way from home and it was out in the country, and leaving was awfully difficult because they only give you 50 pence if you were going to go, and how did you get back to Glasgow with that? So it was always the next day I was going to leave. And those kind of closed communities, which you had no contact with the outside world for the first sort of 3 months, and no phone calls, no letters, no nothing, the atmosphere is quite seductive, and I think that I was probably at that age ripe for a cult. You know, if somebody had approached me to join a cult, I'd have been straight in there. And this was kind of like that, you know. And so I stayed there for 18 months, and I didn't use for 18 months. I have no idea why, really, because there was no drugs there, I think. And they didn't tell us anything about how not to take drugs. They did a lot of telling us how shit we were, and what bad people we were, and how we needed to sort that out. And in some ways, they were right about that. But there was no indication that that abstinence was necessary in order to recover. And at 6 months, we were all allowed to drink. So we all became alcoholics instead. And I did that for a while. And I actually, after I left there, I worked there for a while. So you've got a 21-year-old recovering addict who's become an alcoholic, who's in the business of helping you know, people who've just got clean get clean. I mean, is it any wonder the place didn't work? You know? So I got fired in the end because they had sort of half addict staff and half not addict staff, and I rented my room to some girl who was working there, and she smoked dope, and soon I was smoking dope, and so forth. And that was my first encounter with supposedly getting information that would help me to not use drugs. And so that information was clearly quite flawed because there wasn't any information there at all that was useful. I went through phases of using pills. You know, I didn't have that sort of escalation of starting off smoking hash and then taking whiz and then taking heroin and that. I did sort of do that very early on, but I've had different kind of phases of using in my life. And the period after that, I used a lot of prescription drugs and was forging scripts and stuff, and didn't really use a lot of street drugs for quite a while. And then what happened after that? What happened after that was I got on a methadone script for a while. And then I started having children, right? And all hell broke loose at that point. You're never in good relationships when you're in that kind of state. And I was with this bloke and I got pregnant. And I think I thought at that time that a baby was what I needed. That a baby was an excellent idea for somebody like me, who was actually homeless at the time, by the way, as well. It never entered my head to think, for the way people, you know, a more appropriate way to think about children is, what can I give a child? But I was more interested in what a child could give me. And I thought that was exactly what I needed, was a baby. I needed that relationship. I needed a connection with something, somebody. And it was almost a spiritual yearning that I think that I would recognise it as now. So I had a baby. Brilliant idea, wasn't it? And the baby was born, oddly not addicted. I mean, I was still using, but he was kept under. They knew, and he was kept under observation for a few days, but he was fine. So that was weird. So I took him home, and they've given me a council house. And the relationship with the bloke is just nuts. And then when he was 10 weeks old, my son, because what I decided I was going to do was, if you have a baby, right, you can't be going around scoring heroin. Right? It's just not on, is it, really? So what I decided I would do is that I would use prescription drugs again, because that's fine, because you could be going to the chemist anyway, right? And how would he know? That's how it went in my life. It was perfectly fine to be doing that. And one time I was on my way to the chemist and I locked myself out of the flat and he was in the buggy outside, but the window was open and I had to get back into that flat because the prescription pad that I was writing scripts on was in there. And so that, you know, I had to get back into the flat. So I climbed a ladder to get back into the flat and I fell off a ladder. It was up on the second floor and I broke my back and both my arms. Now, unlike some people who think when these things happen to them, they think, wake up call, you know, you really need to be not doing this stuff. This was a reason for me to do it more. And actually, one of the things that I thought when I broke my back was, excellent, morphine for life. And the first thing that I said after I woke up from them giving me 14 hours of surgery, trying to pin my back together with a bit of my hip like a jigsaw, the first thing I said when I woke up was, I need methadone. And it just goes to show you how far we can go, how driven we are. And they gave you some methadone, actually, because it wasn't worth it. They said it wasn't worth our while arguing with you because you were so ill. And at that point, my son went into care, and I did get him back briefly at that point. But in the end, he went on to be adopted, and he's gone on to. His adoption has gone as well as you could hope for an adoption to go. He's fitted in with that family, and although he's had some problems, I'm okay with the sort of life that he seems to have there. I don't have any contact with him, but I do know a bit about him, and my mother does have contact with the family, and so I get stuff second hand, and he seems to be relatively settled and relatively all right. So the next thing that I did, of course, the obvious step next was to obviously get pregnant again, wasn't it? So I did that, and I was completely nuts during that pregnancy. I was homeless, and I had my daughter, and she was born addicted. And of course, social services begin to notice these things. And they started to intervene, and things. If I hadn't had children, I would probably. I can see how I could have carried on using unnoticed for forever. Really, I was good at earning money, and although I got arrested from time to time, it was relatively low key. But once you start, nobody was particularly interested in helping me, and I wasn't ever interested in stopping. Not really. But when you start having children, lots of people start getting involved. And when I had my daughter, she was removed at birth. And I decided at that point, that I wanted to get clean, and they put me into detox. And I'd always failed at detoxes before, and I tried it a few times, but I get to like day one and a half, right? And just the thought of what I'm going to face is overwhelming to me, and I leave. I don't even wait for it to start, you know. At the first sneeze, I'm out of there. And when I've signed into that detox place, I fucking meant it. You know, I meant that I wanted to detox. It was just beyond what I could face, and I'd be gone. But they put me in a detox place in this hospital way out in the country outside Reading, and leaving was hard. There wasn't any public transport for miles. Once you start to feel a bit ill, just quite tricky to do. They also did a blind detox with me, where they gave me, they just gave me a bottle of methadone every day and didn't tell me how much, what concentration it was. And by day, you know, about halfway through, they had to have two people sign for it, and some locum person came in. They weren't supposed to tell me how much it was, and he said, "Oh, you're down to like 10 mils now." And I was like, whoa, you know, usually at 25 mils, that's life's unbearable to me. So at that point, I thought it was going to be doable. And I did do that. And then they put me in a mother and baby unit in Peckham without my daughter. For ages, I didn't get my daughter. I won't go through that whole drama of social services refusing to hand over my child. I had lawyers left, right and centre. And there were hair samples, and it was just a huge palaver. But in the end, they did give her to me. And that was where I came across NA for the first time. Now, we had heard of NA when I was working in that treatment centre, but so 81, 82, 83, that sort of time. But it was never anything that we took seriously. And I'm not sure why, really. I think they thought it was God Squad. I'm not sure. But it was never anything we would have ever recommended to anyone to do. But I did. I went to my first NA meeting then, because I got a babysitter, and it was my kind of evening out, if you like. And I met some people there. And the first meeting that I went to was in a church, and it had an aisle up the middle of it, and there were two rows of people sitting, and there was a stage at the front with somebody sitting at the top of it. And on the walls, it had these things that have got the word God all over them. And I thought, I walked in and went, oh, this is like a religion, right? I hadn't realised that, you see. And I honestly expect, I was waiting for when they actually started to sing hymns. Because it was set up like a church. But there was something about that, and there was a big meeting. It was a Brixton meeting. It was a big meeting. It always has been a big meeting. And there's something that I can't, something sort of intangible about it as well, that I instinctively knew that I was among people that were the same as me. That is all I can say about that. I can't explain that. And I kept going back. Now, I'm not sure I kept going back because I thought it would help me stop taking drugs, because I was actually clean then in this treatment centre, so I thought I had stopped taking drugs, get me? I went back the next week because they gave me a free babysitter, and it was sort of for company, I think, as well. And also the place where I was, the mother and baby unit that I was in, everybody was using. So it was sort of a bit of sanity, I guess. And people were friendly. You know, I went back the next week and somebody said, "Hello, Louise," frightened the fucking life out of me. I didn't remember my name. I carried on going to NA there for a couple of years. I got custody of my daughter, but my experience was, and I stayed clean all in all for about 4 years. Then I had a horrendous relapse, and I've just sort of briefly run through why I think that happened, because I want to spend some time about and talking about how I've got clean now, and that is. People say to me, "Oh, you just weren't ready." And I don't buy that. I think I was perfectly ready at that point. I didn't go to any with an intent to do it wrong, right? But I didn't extract the information that I needed to extract from it. And whilst it's all in the book, folks, I'm not sure that I really read the book properly with any sense of its importance. I certainly didn't read it with anybody, and I think that book is intended to be read with somebody who can illuminate what it's saying to you, and I didn't have that. And so, and I did get a sponsor, because they said at meetings you should get a sponsor, so I got a sponsor. I never asked her if she'd done the 12 steps, and I didn't know if that was important or not, and nobody said to me I should. But she was a nice girl, and she had a car, and she used to pick me up and take me to the meetings, and she was kind, and she was clean. And I thought that was all it took. So, I mean, this was a woman who hadn't done any of the steps herself, so it was the blind leading the blind. And she meant well, but she couldn't tell me how to stay clean. She didn't know herself. And so I stopped going to meetings, but I didn't make a decision, oh, I'm not going to go back to meetings. By that time, my daughter was 3. Meetings were quite difficult. There weren't creche meetings then. She was hearing stuff. She was a bit of a handful, you know. And it just became less convenient to go to meetings. I had made some friends, and I saw them, and it just kind of tailed off, and I stopped going. And over time, and I didn't start using for ages, I mean, a couple of years. But what I didn't notice, and in hindsight, what I can see now is that I gradually went really quite mad, and I didn't notice. I started to get irritated. Everybody and everything started to piss me off, I blamed everybody for any problem that I had, and life just became a bit grueling. I had all sorts of problems with my back, and when I went to the doctor and said, I've got all sorts of problems with my back, and he said, well, you've not used for 4 years now, you can take some codeine, can't you? I said, yes, I can. And I did, and I tell you, it was weeks before I was out forging scripts again, a matter of weeks. It is possible to take painkillers in recovery safely, but it is hard, let me tell you. I have done it since, I had an operation in recovery since. It is hard. And it says in the book, in More Will Be Revealed, I think, how if we need to have medication, we are at our most vulnerable. And I tell you what, it is not kidding. Because no matter how straight you think your head is, when you get some opiates in your system, it really messes with you. And I'd have that bottle of pills in the cupboard, and they would be calling to me. And I didn't want to use. I thought I was using these drugs in a manageable way, and I was really in pain, by the way. It says on the bottle, take 2 every 4 to 6 hours. My mother said to me once, has it ever occurred to you to take 1? No, never entered my head to take 1. And 4 to 6 hours, well, 3 hours is like 4 hours, isn't it? And then, and gradually, you're using. You know, and it's not that gradual either, that's what I found. So, you know, if you're ever in that sort of position, like, get people around you who will tell you the truth. And get, you know, if I was to be prescribed, if I had to take stuff now, I would get all the help I could, I swear. So I started using it, and that went horrendously wrong and escalated really badly, and I probably had my worst phase of street drug using, which carried on for about 4 or 5 years, and I was an injector, and I was physically in a really bad way. Very underweight, my teeth are falling out, and of course I had this little baby, I had this little toddler with me, and my mother intervened and got social services involved. There had been some minor skirmishes. I got arrested out shoplifting with her, and they got involved but weren't actually that interested in me, but my mother became a sort of driving force behind my daughter going into care. And I've still got issues around that, that's my kind of problem. My daughter got removed, and again, like when I brought my back, instead of that being an indication that I should do something, that became a reason for me to use more. I mean, I completely fell apart at that stage. I don't know about that. You know, I hear some women who say, well, I got pregnant and clearly that was when I should stop using, and they stop using, and they stop using. But and I wonder, what the fuck was wrong with me? But I kind of want, you know, I felt very, very alone during that phase. I felt like nobody was in my corner. And I felt overwhelmed by the dominance of my mother throughout the whole thing. And I just, I didn't even fight for her. I couldn't face it. And I just sort of dug myself into a hole and used and used and used and used. And I didn't really care if I died or not. And a couple of times I got arrested and remanded during that period, and I would, no doubt in my mind that my life was saved by getting arrested. And on one occasion, they detox you in prison, it's not optional. I got to the sort of very end of the detox. I was having some reasonably lucid thoughts. Oh, by the way, good story. I always get a single cell when I go into Holloway because I can't bear sharing with people, so I tell them that I hear voices on reception. That's how you get a single cell. And I went into my single cell with my little pillow and my little blankets and my plastic fork and my cup and that. And there's supposed to be nothing in the cell apart from the bed, your little cupboard, and this thing that's supposed to be stripped bare. And when I went into the cell, it was completely bare apart from a book that was on the window ledge. And can you guess what it was? It was a basic test. And so, make of that what you will, I know what I think. And so I read the basic text, and I also watched, it was the time when the Open was on, I also watched 9 hours of golf a day. Which is great. I'm really grateful for that being on the telly. I love a bit of golf, and I was ill when I was detoxed. It was brilliant. And I had this kind of moment, and I wouldn't describe it as a dramatic moment, but I do know it was my rock bottom. You know, I didn't have, you know, I wasn't tearing my hair out or anything, but there was a moment when I turned around and when I thought, right, I'm going to go to NA and I'm just going to do what they tell me. There was a kind of inherent thing in me that wanted to give it a go. And so I came out of prison, but I got a guy in 5-10 minutes. I came out of prison, and this is another good thing about my story, because we say that recovery is possible in NA, but we hear a lot of people talking about being in treatment and having counsellors and having all sorts of other help. I had nothing. Nothing but any. I walked out of prison, and the next day I went to a meeting. Actually, the first day the meeting that I went to was shut. But I didn't use that day. And I went to a meeting the next day. It was quite nerve-wracking because I thought, what people are there that I know? What if there's nobody there that I know? I thought I was well sensible during that period. But looking back, I was mad as a hatter. But what I did have was I knew that I had to find out what it was that people did to stay clean. I suppose I was, I guess you could call it judgmental. I like to think of it as being selective. I approached people who were clean. There was a few people around who had been around when I'd been in NA before, and this is like, you know, 5-10 years later. There weren't very many, by the way, but there were a few, and I asked them all, I said, you're still clean, what did you do? And they all told me the same things, which were, they never stopped going to meetings, they did the steps, they did some service. I did that. And there were some people who, you know, lots of people go to meetings, and there's lots of people at different kind of stages of recovery and different kind of stages of understanding. But the people who know what they're talking about, you know them when you hear them. And I stuck by those people. And I can't tell you, I'm just so grateful that they were around and had time for me. There were some people that whatever they told me I needed to do, I wouldn't question it. And I just got on with it. And I got a sponsor, I got a good sponsor who had loads of time for me. And I ploughed on through the steps virtually straight away, as soon as I could. And I would urge you, if you're ambivalent about that and wondering on the steps, will I or will I not, I would say crack on with it as soon as you can. You won't find anyone who's done it who says, no, I wish I'd left that for a couple of years before I started that. I defy you to find anyone that says that. And the other thing, that apart from that real practical kind of, here's what you need to do to stay clean, so, you know, you need a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, let me take you through them, that stuff. I had just a tremendous amount of love from the fellowship. And because I came out of prison, I was homeless. I was a shoplifter, so I had the clothes I stood up in and nothing else, because what I used to do was, when those clothes got dirty, I would steal some more and just throw those ones away. And so I had nothing but the clothes I stood up in. And I had my little Holloway toothbrush and my little Holloway knickers, because I give you a couple of prison knickers in there. That's what I had. And they put me in a bail hostel, which was on Shoot Up Hill, unbelievably. When they came into the cell and said to me, we're sending you to a bail hostel and the address is Shoot Up Hill, I thought they were taking the mic. But no, it was true. I was there for 6 months or so. I shared a room with somebody who was using the whole way through. Two different ones. The first one was on special brew and crack. She was a lot of fun. And the second one was on heroin and nicked all my stuff. But she was quiet. and I got through that. I was on a curfew as well, and I would go to meetings that would finish. I had to be back at 9 o'clock, and people knew this, and they would, you know, be like that at the end of the meeting, right, let's get in the car and get her back. And I just can't tell the stuff that people did for me. I had no clothes. People gave me clothes. I was living on crisis loans for months. And people fed me. I lived on the biscuits from meetings for ages. And then people would say to me, I went to a Friday night meeting where I got a commitment straight away, and they would, every Friday night they would say, are you hungry? And I would say, I've got no money. And they would say, I didn't ask you if you had any money. And every week they took me out for a year on a Friday night. One of those people, and I was such a mess, my teeth falling out and just so thin and grim looking and this stringy hair. And one night I was walking across Waterloo Bridge after that meeting with someone, and he turned around and he gave me £100 cash and said, go get your hair cut and buy yourself some makeup. And it was one of the most touching things that MD has ever done for me, just a real bit of human kindness. I tell you, I could talk for the next hour about things like that people have done for me. And for that reason, I've always felt very involved. You know, it was no problem to me to do service in NA. Oh, it's the least I could do. And I had commitments straight away. My first one was a tea person. Of course, they turned me into a monster with that, because it was like a banquet. It was like Patisserie Valerie. And I didn't let anybody touch the sugar. Yeah, don't put that wet spoon in the sugar, yeah. So I got a little bit, but it was the first thing I'd done with any real pride. I can't go through what I've got from every step now, because I don't have the time. But each one has been, there's a spiritual principle associated with every step. And you sort of pick them up as you go along. Put that one under my belt. Put that one under my belt. Try and do that one for a while. And sort of collectively, over time, it's just like juggling or spinning plates or something. And at first, it's a huge effort to do all those things. Like, for example, I was a thief. I never paid for anything. And just to go into a shop and pay for something, that was a huge internal struggle for me. And I really had to consciously make a decision to pay. But now, it doesn't even enter my head to steal. So that's just quite a concrete example of things that used to be hard work, which now are no effort at all. And I guess that over time, you sort of incrementally build a bit of self-respect. And there's lots of things that we talk about in the steps, and lots of the readings we used to talk about, which rationally, you know, make sense. But I have found that it has taken time for me to feel better about myself, really, you know. It has taken time for me to feel that I'm a decent human being. I think the only way to believe that you're a respectable, decent person is to be a respectable, decent person. And just do it, and keep doing it, and keep doing it, and keep doing it, until in the end, you are, and you know it, and you can't deny it. And it becomes much harder to beat yourself up about stuff. It becomes much harder to allow yourself to be shortchanged. And I learned all of that, how to do all of that through NA, with people giving me all this information, all their time, for free. Amazing. I came here. I'll just give you a sort of roll call of all the things that I have achieved, because I've achieved quite a bit. I've only been clean 6 years. Now, I was clean 6 years last week, and it is 6 years. I know when you're first around, 6 years just sounds like, you know, I'm lucky if I can do 6 days. Yeah. But in the general scheme of things, this is not a long time at all, right? And what I've done, you know, I've done a degree, I'm completely unemployable, never turned up for anything in my life. I've got a degree in journalism. Somebody said, you'd be a good journalist. I went, yeah, that's a great idea, I'm really going to be a good journalist. and not some Mickey Mouse degree either. I went to the best university in the country for it, which unbelievably accepted me, and did a degree in journalism there. Within moments of that, I was working at a national newspaper. I just can't tell you how all these things slotted into place, because it's the sort of mystery of the universe, how all that stuff happens. And I've been working as a journalist for about 4 years now. I interviewed at Christmas, I interviewed this guy who is he's the chief executive of a global company. And I did this profile of him. And then a few months ago, he phoned me up. He was coming, he's based in New York. He came over to London and he said, I want to meet you. And I thought he was going to offer me a job in PR. And I thought, I don't really want to work in PR, but if he offers me stupid money, I'll do it. But he didn't. He said to me, I'd like you to write a book for me. Name your price. And so I went, I'll get back to you about that. And so that's what I'm doing now. You know, it's quite a risky thing to give up a regular income as a paid writer. On a publication to do something like that, but my employers asked me if I would stay on one day a week, because get this, they think having me on the staff role gives them some credibility. And that's only 6 years now, and that's the sort of career stuff, and that's all sort of, you know, great, and I'm earning some proper money now, which is amazing. I bought a car and a new computer. I'm like, ooh, what am I going to buy next? But everything that I've bought, you know, I bought that car, and every time I get in that car, I am just so glad I've got one now. I really appreciate, because I went, you know, I got a lot of buses and did a lot of walking, but. It's more the kind of spiritual turnaround that I have, that I appreciate more than everything else. And I can sum it up quite simply in that I have become, instead of a person who only looked for what they could get out of the world, I've done a complete 180-degree turn, and I'm now a person who thinks about what they can put into the world. And the paradox of that is, when you give, you get to receive, and you get to receive without there being any fear associated with what you're going to get and what you're going to keep. And I didn't even know that that was possible to be like that. I'm very lucky. I don't have any contact with my children. I've just made friends with my daughter on Facebook. Very dramatic. That's all. It's very problematic, that, and I've got lots of stuff attached to that, which clearly is going to be ongoing for the rest of my days. That's my tragedy. You try and bear your pain with a bit of dignity, really, and appreciate what not having them gives me, which is, it gives me tremendous freedom in some ways to make risky decisions that I couldn't take if I had care of children. But, you know, I've got a great partner. We have custody of his children at the weekends, so I do have a little bit of family life. I need to finish now, Gary, don't I? And so I don't know if I've done that very well or not, but I think it's a... you know, it's only 6 years. It's pretty good, isn't it, really? And I have NA to be thankful for every single bit of it. So thank you.
Celebrate Queen's and Kieran's claps and hopes, and for that I'm going to hand it back to tonight's speech.